From KCRW, this is Greater LA. It's the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. The Holocaust was a horrific time in human history. So many lives lost. But also historical records, community ties, and cultural artifacts such as family heirlooms and artwork. One Jewish family, the Blocks, came here to Los Angeles after fleeing their home country of Czechoslovakia back in 1938. And they wanted to reclaim some of what they'd lost, specifically a treasured 17th century painting that was stolen from them by the Nazis. They fought for decades to get the painting back, and they succeeded. And now that struggle is the subject of a new exhibition at the Skirball Center. Cheryl Bernstein is the great-granddaughter of Jewish Czech industrialist Johann Bloch, and Alyssa Shapiro is associate curator and collection specialist over at the Skirball, and they're both here now to talk about the exhibition and the story, too. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi, Steve.
Alyssa, first of all, tell us about the painting itself. What is it of, and who painted it?
It's a 17th century painting created by a German artist named Johann Karl Loth, who spent most of his career in Venice, Italy. And he was someone who took inspiration from both mythological stories as well as biblical stories. And this one in particular comes from the book of Genesis in the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Bible. And it shows Isaac blessing Jacob.
Cheryl, tell me a little bit about your great-grandparents and how they came to own this piece of work, this painting. They were quite the art collectors, right?
So they were art collectors. I don't know too much about them because part of what you lose when your family's ripped apart by a war and Holocaust is you lose your family history and the oral history. What I do know is that they bonded over their love of art. They actually built the home that it hung in right before my grandmother was born. It was built for her birth, basically, and they filled it with art treasures.
The Nazis occupied Czechoslovakia, which is current-day Czech Republic, and your grandparents and your mother fled to the U.S., and they settled here in L.A. What became of your great-grandfather and his art collection?
So my great-grandfather also tried to flee, and we have a lot of paperwork that he was working on export permits and exit visas to get out, and he tragically died of a heart attack in December 1940, waiting for those documents to come. So he never made it out. We don't really know what happened to his art collection. We know that immediately when they invaded his home, his assets were frozen and everything was seized. They actually turned his house into housing for the Luftwaffe. But through these export permits that he was trying to obtain, he listed a lot of the art. And the Nazis would write things telling him that in exchange for donating, quote unquote, donating some art, he would get permits. But we also know that the Loth in particular was sold at auction. Help me here. It was sold at auction in 1939.
It was stolen from the house in, we believe, the late summer of 1939. And the family was told, Johann was told, that it was in Prague in a warehouse with the rest of his art collection, at which time the National Gallery of Prague did an inventory of all of Johann's works. But we know from records that even though the National Gallery of Prague claimed that the painting was in storage in Prague at that time, several months earlier, it had been sold at the Dorotheum Auction House in Vienna.
But one of the things that made it even more difficult to track down is that when the Nazis sold it at auction, the name of the artist and the name of the painting was changed.
Was that so it couldn't be traced?
Well, we don't know exactly, though what we do know is that by changing the name of the artist to a better known Baroque painter of the same period, Luca Giordano, that the estimated value of it was much higher than it was under the name of Johann Karl Loth.
I've heard, Alyssa, about some other stolen artworks being returned to Jewish families who lost them during the Holocaust. How many works were lost that way? How hard is it to even reclaim them in the first place?
Incredibly hard. You have to have proof that your things were stolen. And the Nazis, one thing that they did that helps Holocaust scholars like myself is they kept often meticulous records. And under the guise of legality, often had contracts written up to say, you know, we are buying this from you, or we're taking this from you here because of X, Y, or Z reason. So we don't really have numbers, but in my own research, I've looked at prominent Jewish art gallerists, and they had hundreds, if not thousands, of works stolen. So you multiply that by how many places that the Nazis occupied. If you even think just about the Jewish families and their works of art or the works by Jewish artists in national museums in Germany, that number is extraordinary. And then you broaden it out after Germany takes over Austria and then Czechoslovakia and then Poland and then all through Western Europe. And for a lot of institutions that have works of art that were stolen by the Nazis from Jewish families, they don't want to give back things if the original owners can't definitively prove that not only they owned these works, but that they were forcibly taken by the Nazis.
In the exhibition, Cheryl, the painting is displayed in a recreation of your great-grandparents' dining room, right, back in Czechoslovakia, where the painting was originally hung. What does it feel like? I mean, I guess the question is, what kind of emotions are coming out with this work being found?
First of all, I want to say that my grandmother was so incredibly smart and forward-thinking. As she's fleeing in the middle of the night with her toddler, she had the presence of mind to take the professional photographs of the inside of her father's home with her. And the minute she found out her father had died and she got the telegram, they started working on his estate. Her and her sister and Erna, who tragically died in the concentration camps, started this process right away. And my grandmother and I were very close growing up, yet it was never discussed. I knew she was from Czechoslovakia. I knew we were Jewish. But to be honest, she raised my mother Catholic, and my mother didn't realize it. And it was a slow realization for my mother. And when my grandmother died, my mother picked up the process and started trying to reclaim what she had. And then I'm the third generation. Going through this process, you learn so much about your family. You find your roots. I'm incredibly close to my mother now as we've worked on this process together. Bringing something like the Loth painting back to your family that my grandmother worked on all her life, that my mother literally gets to see, is a very tangible step towards putting the pieces of your life back together that you didn't even know. Me as the third generation, I didn't realize were missing. And it's extraordinary. It's more than words I can put into words.
It's an incredible story. And I want to thank you both for coming on and telling it. Cheryl Bernstein, descendant of the Bloch family, whose reclaimed painting is the focus now of a new exhibition over at the Skirball. Alyssa Shapiro is the museum's associate curator and collection specialist. And the new exhibition is called Reclaimed, a Family Painting, that opens at the Skirball next week. Cheryl, Alyssa, thanks for coming on and talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Walter Mosley is one of LA's most famous authors. He's best known for his crime novels featuring Private Eye Easy Rawlins, played in the movie Devil in a Blue Dress by Denzel Washington.
So how well did you know Coretta?
She was a very close friend.
So maybe you know why she got killed? Why would I know that?
Said she was a very close friend. She knew about you and Frank. Maybe somebody wanted to keep that secret.
Mr. Rawlins, if you're thinking...
Easy. You can call me Easy.
Easy, if you're thinking that Frank had anything to do with Coretta's death, then obviously you don't know very much about him.
But Walter Mosley is prolific. He has written something like 60 books. His latest will probably end up on the sci-fi shelves in your local bookstore. It's called Touched. And it's my pleasure now to welcome Walter Mosley to Greater L.A. An honor, sir. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you.
I was surprised when I saw that you'd written a science fiction novel, but then I found out that it's not your first one.
No, it's the 12th.
It's the 12th one.
Yeah.
Are you a fan of science fiction? Do you read a lot of sci-fi?
Yeah, big fan. I love science fiction. You know, but, you know, listen, I like books, so I read everything. I write in all genres, and I like books.
The opening of your new one, called Touched, starts with this main character. His name is Martin Just, and he wakes up in his bed, and he's next to his wife, and his two kids are in their rooms, and everything is as it should be, but for some reason, he's not the same person he was when he went to bed, when he went to sleep. I mean, I guess set up a little bit about what happened to Martin Just.
I mean, the book it covers a lot of space, you know, no pun intended, really, but it does. It starts, for us, it starts today, but for Martin, it starts at maybe, you know, just microseconds after the Big Bang. And the notion here is that when the Big Bang happens, these incredibly large and powerful intelligence forms come through, and they remember everything that happened before, and they try to make adjustments to what's going to happen in the next iteration of existence. And these beings have decided that in the last iteration of existence, the chromosome molecule is the most dangerous disease in the universe. And it has to be, at the very least, halted in its progression, if not completely destroyed. And Martin Just is one of 107 individuals who have been given certain powers and the idea that they have to stem the advancement of the chromosome molecule.
There's a passage that kind of whittles it down, right? That what's going on with Martin Just? Would you mind reading that? It's near the top of page 3.
I can remember only some of it now. After the first skirmish in an intergalactic invasion, there was a place that gave the impression of many shades of blue, but I can't say if my eyes were working there. I was aware of different beings from a vast range of planes and realities. They spoke to me, but in ways that transformed rather than informed me. They were like a congress that met only once, decided on the fates of worlds, and then disbanded when their words, their enunciations, had been received and digested. My world, they said, was wrong. The planet itself had spawned a disease of which I was a part. This contagion had begun to multiply, and it had to be rendered impotent by any means necessary.
So that's a powerful idea, and kind of, you know, it's kind of hard to argue with that humans have become kind of a disease on the planet, given, you know, that the planet is not happy at the moment and seems to be getting unhappier. Do you see us that way, human beings that way? Is that where the idea came from?
No, I don't. I mean, but, you know, but I could see how we might be seen that way. And certainly, you know, many life forms on this planet would see humans like that. But I'm not just talking about the human race. You know, one thing when I'm writing science fiction, I try to stay away from being human-centric, you know. But even if humanity stopped completely, the decree from these beings, these very early beings, would still be the chromosome is still a danger.
Race also plays a big role in the book. Martin Just is black.
Mm-hmm.
Twice, LAPD come into his home and physically assault him. A trio of white supremacists come with a plan to beat him up and kill him and his family, too.
Mm-hmm.
But those white supremacists have a profound change of heart. And one of them says, I'm sorry for what we did and what we was gonna do. I don't even understand it now. That's quite a turn, right?
What I've been trying lately, you know, to understand that, you know, the class issues in America and very probably much of the rest of the world, you know, are based in separating people, individuals, into groups. Well, you belong to this group, you know, this religion, this nationality, this race, this gender, this age. And, you know, indeed, it's my thinking that if we don't work together, we don't work at all. And that's what that is about in this book. You know, these people have to learn how to work together. They don't have to learn how to love each other. They just have to learn how to work together.
Well, and not kill each other.
Yeah.
And not try and do harm to one another.
Well, that's true, though I don't think that is the argument. The argument is, yes, you shouldn't, you know, fight and kill each other, but, you know, we do that. So the thing in the end becomes, my life is going to be better if I work with you. What we're trying to achieve here is going to happen if I work with you, and it's not if I don't. It's kind of that simple. There are things that are good. You know, people aren't killing each other and beating each other up and hurting each other and ripping each other off. And of course, those are things I want. But that's not the argument. The argument is, well, if we want to live and we want to live well, we need to work together.
I want to talk about your very first published novel, which was Devil in a Blue Dress. And just a few years after it came out, it was made into a movie, which is exciting. We heard the clip with Denzel Washington playing your famous, you know, private eye, Easy Rollins. What was that experience like?
That was great. It was wonderful. You know, it was wonderful to write a book, and then it was wonderful to publish a book, and then the book became a movie. All of that was kind of really fun for me. It was really fun. What can I say?
I mean,
I'm a hedonist. I like enjoying my life.
Well, I think you and everybody else, right? I mean, it's sort of the human condition.
Some people not so much.
That's true. But this is Hollywood. This is L.A., right? We like the attention.
Yeah.
You grew up here in L.A., but then you moved to New York even before you started writing, right?
Yeah. I lived in L.A. until until I graduated from high school. After high school, I didn't live in L.A. too much anymore. I've been around there a lot lately because I've been working there, you know, doing film and television. But most of my years, I spent 7 years in Vermont, a few years in Massachusetts, and then a good 40 years in New York. I'm in New York right now, as a matter of fact.
You like New York? It's a good place for you?
I love New York. It's a great city.
Yeah. But you're in New York, and so many of your writings, you know, include or are based in L.A. Did it have that much of a profound impact?
Well, L.A., well, listen, I was born and raised in L.A. I know L.A., and I love L.A. I think it's a great place to tell certain kinds of stories. But the same thing's true of New York. You know, I write a lot about New York, and I think it's really cool. And sometimes I write about Georgia, and sometimes I write about, you know, other places. But this is an interesting thing for me. I mean, it's not place and identity. I'm not really sure how it works with me, but it's not like I said, well, I'm a New Yorker, I'm a Los Angelino, or I'm a, you know, whatever.
But place has something to do with who you are, right? Like where you grew up, you know, and you remember those things.
It's really true. But there's two things. Who I am and how I identify are really different things. And I think that's true for most people. You know, I mean, some people, they're born in a place. They want to live in that place. I am of that place. I'm not really like that. I can leave a place and be gone from it for years. Like, for instance, I didn't spend much time in L.A. for 40 years after I left, or even more, maybe 50. You know, but then one day I showed up again. You know, John Singleton called me and said, I'm doing a television show. It's called Snowfall. We're doing it in L.A. I said, okay. You know, and I came out and I spent, you know, a lot of that 7 years of that show working with John. Well,
yeah.
He died halfway through, but, you know, first working with him and then working for him.
Why does Touched take place in L.A.? Is there a reason, or is it just where it is?
Yeah, you know, I started writing and it was in L.A. You know, L.A., there's a lot of outside and moving around in among people. And it's easier to do that. It's so funny because, you know, New York is a pedestrian city. People are in the streets everywhere. But it's, you know, kind of pressed in by the architecture. It's a much smaller, you know, physical space with many more people. And so it was easier to get my characters outside of, you know, their domiciles in Los Angeles. And so I think that's why I did it, you know, having people live up in the Hollywood Hills.
Walter Mosley, the latest novel is called Touched. Walter, thanks for coming on and talking with us. We appreciate it.
And thanks a lot for having me. Thank you very much.
Even more now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's the time of year up in Sacramento when bills live or die. Governor Newsom has been signing or vetoing hundreds of bills before the deadline this Saturday. And this time around, a few of those happen to deal with the hospitality industry. And with me to talk about some of the legislative hospitality happenings is Eater LA's Mona Holmes, of course, a regular right here on GLA. Hi, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
This is not the usual topic of conversation. Normally, you're trying to make me hungry, right? Like talking about food, the latest delicious foods to arrive all across Southern California. Why are we talking about laws now, hospitality laws?
Okay, so legislation that comes from Sacramento, it has a huge impact on our daily lives, even in the world of restaurants. So I've been covering this industry since 2017, and I'm used to this time of year just completely changing tons in food spaces. Like one of the best examples came from a few years ago when Jerry Brown was still governor, when he decriminalized street vending. And as you know, street vendors are huge in California and, of course, Los Angeles. There's even stuff that came down very quickly in the fall concerning alcohol laws or dining in California during the pandemic. And these decisions directly impact businesses and the employees who provide the food and, of course, those of us who consume it. So I keep an eye out on these all the time.
Anything that popped out at you that he did sign that's going to change a lot of how we go out and dine out?
Well, everyone should know by now about Assembly Bill 1228. This is an unprecedented law that really works in the favor of fast food workers in the state of California. This has the potential to be something really huge and maybe even adopted by other states in the country. It includes wage hikes, worker protections, safety protections, along with a fast food council that includes workers, state workers, and employers for fast food establishments. This actually passed last month. Newsom actually came to Los Angeles to sign the bill with a group of workers that started this whole thing, really, from a Boyle Heights McDonald's. So that's the one that really, really stood out for me.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to hear it because these workers were complaining about wage theft, about worker safety. So this is very much a good law.
One of the bills that got the big red X from Gavin Newsom would have allowed for cannabis cafes, kind of like in Amsterdam, right? You and I have talked about cannabis cafes on this show.
Yes, we have.
Which, by the way, and we'll get to, they're still legal in some parts, but why did Gavin Newsom veto that statewide?
This law would have allowed the cannabis industry to have this huge opportunity. It would have allowed customers to have something other than just psychoactive drinks and food in the dispensary. They could have had just a regular burger that didn't have anything in it, or a soda. But these laws in California are really tricky. It's illegal for dispensaries to sell these foods, right? But this would have cleared the way for them to compete against the thriving cannabis black market in California. And so this could have been really huge. You know, West Hollywood, Los Angeles, everyone has a huge number of dispensaries, but Newsom vetoed it, saying that it violated California's smoke-free workplace protections. So there's that. But you know, these dispensaries are really struggling. The prices are arguably much higher than what people can find on the street. And so this bill, Assembly Bill 374, was designed to help give them a leg up and maybe even survive.
A bill that the governor did sign feels kind of like it came out of COVID. It loosens restrictions on cooks who work out of their homes. It's called the Micro Enterprise Home Kitchen Operations Law. Did I get that right?
You got that right.
All right. So talk a little bit about that one.
I actually really love this law. I get cookies from a specific business that utilizes Assembly Bill 325, or at least its predecessor. This law strengthens the abilities of home cooks who sell food to the public to make it just a ton easier for them. There's usually ample red tape, and some of it is warranted, you know, for public safety, and the others are just a maze of, best way to describe it is just costly bureaucracy. So the new law was initially written to make sure that home food entrepreneurs could get more revenue. But now they're able to sell 90 meals per week versus 60. They're also able to earn $100,000 annually versus 50. And also it redefines what they can sell. And I don't know about you, but I've had some of the best stuff from home cooks, and I think that they should be supported. And that's exactly what AB 1325 does.
Mona Holmes, a regular here on Greater LA, of course, writes for Eater LA. Mona, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
That's all the time we have. Tomorrow, will new changing criteria help more people get housed with Mayor Karen Bass's Inside Safe program? We'll try and answer that question coming up tomorrow on GLA. Check us out online anytime at kcrw.com/GLA. Tell us how you're doing. Share a story idea. Grab the podcast so you can take it on the go, won't you? kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Michael Stark, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Jocelyn Rohrbach, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on today's episode. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for the time. Thanks for the year. Have a great day.